found it all over. Don't get me wrong, I liked the skinny ones, too, but a girl like Kiwi always made my eyes rove over her more than other types did.
"I have to go over the shock sticks," she said. "We've never trained with them before."
I frowned at her. "What? I've used a powered baton more than once." She shook her head.
"I thought that too, but these units are new. They're long, like spears. They have tips that deliver a powerful jolt."
"Are the tips pointed?" I asked.
"Yes, but they aren't sharpened like you would expect. The metal heads are charged and weighted with a point that's a rounded surface about a centimeter across."
"Hmm," I said. "Sounds like the tip of a bullet. Not truly sharp, but still enough to hurt you if you hit someone hard with it."
"Or if you hit them in a sensitive spot like an eye,"
she agreed.
"But that's not the real change. The main thing is their amperage. They do more than sting. They numb the body. You tend to lose the function of anything that's touched with a charged spear."
"Spears," I said. "The oldest of weapons, except maybe for the club and the knife. Well, we'll make the best of it." My hand-picked crew was waiting for me in the foyer just outside the exercise chamber. We were at the northeast corner, and I knew the three noob teams were gathering in similar spots at the other three corners. "Do we know yet which group is gathering at which corner?" I asked her. She gave me a sly look.
"Not officially."
That made me smile. "Buzzers? You've got buzzers out there?"
"Shh," she said.
"Why, Kiwi," I laughed. "You're cheating for your friends, aren't you? No wonder Graves said no techs allowed last night."
"What good would I be as a tech if I didn't at least scout for my team?"
she asked. "What good indeed. Show me what you've got." She lifted her tapper and we viewed a few brief clips. Her tiny, insectile drones had located and identified the enemy officers. Each of them was haranguing recruits in their typical fashion. Leeson was making a dull speech. Toro was walking around making lots of noise and hand gestures. Harris, being more hands-on, was lining his people up and having them all do stop thrusts with their spears. He walked behind them, screaming in their ears and slapping anyone who did it wrong. "They look scared," I said.
"They should be," Kiwi replied. "What are you going to do to them?"
I gave her a little grin. "I'm not telling. You can watch from the observation booth." Her full lips pouted, but she didn't complain.
"Leeson is directly across from you, in the southwest corner. Harris is southeast, to your left as you walk in. Toro is on your right, northwest."
"Good work. Now get out of here and hide your bugs before I'm disqualified or something." She ran off, and Carlos walked up to replace her.
"Still lusting for my girl, McGill?"
he asked. "Isn't it a violation to pork your non-coms now that you're a centurion?"
"Nope," I said firmly.
"Not in this unit, anyway. Are the troops ready?"
"We're here, and we're ready to die pointlessly at your command."
"Good." Carlos was the only bio I had in my hand-picked group. Partly I'd chosen him because he was a capable hand-to-hand fighter as well as a medical type. Most bios were soft, but not him. The rest of my crew consisted of the most vicious fighters in my unit. Among them were Sargon and Della. She was small, but she was a natural-born killer with a knife in her hand. "Okay, team, we're going low-tech this time around. When we get in there, follow my lead. Della, you take point." She looked surprised, but didn't complain. "The terrain is set for jungle rough," I told them. "It'll be hot and hazy. Greenery will block vision more than 10 meters in most places. Della, I want you to run to the center, grab the flag, and hide it." She looked confused.
She said. "Aren't we supposed to fight over it?"
"We're supposed to be the last team holding it for 30 minutes, I said. "Fighting is purely optional." Several of my team nodded thoughtfully. They weren't arguing, at least, and I liked that. "Okay," I said. "The rest of you follow my lead when we get in there."
"No hints, Centurion?" Sargon asked.
"Nope."
He shrugged and began stretching near the closed hatchway.
"Wait a second,"
Della said, coming up to me as I stood next to Sargon.
That's the whole plan?
Nah, I said. I have some other thoughts, but I'll tell you about them when we get inside. She narrowed her eyes at me.
Are you worried about spies?
Yes, indeed. She nodded and looked around suspiciously.
Wise. I must ask you, though, what if the flag doesn't come free from the center? What if it's stuck in a Puff Creek base?
That made me frown. I hadn't considered such a possibility. Well, you've got a knife. Cut the flag off and run away with it. Sit in a tree or something. She made a face that indicated resignation and took her place at the front of the pack. A digital counter began running on everyone's tapper at once. It started at 59 and began counting down. Chapter 18. When the count reached zero, the hatch opened and we all sprinted inside. Carlos was whooping like an ape and I almost felt like joining him. Our legs churned and big ferns slapped them wetly as we charged through the tangled rainforest. The trees were quick grows with spindly roots, but they were good enough to fool me. Damn, this biotech was amazing. They'd grown an honest-to-God jungle in here overnight. I knew the trees were weak, about as tough as stalks of witch grass, but they looked great and felt solid enough when you slammed into one. The moment we all got into the jungle, the hatch clanged shut behind us. We were locked in now and committed. Today it was do or die for the 120-odd lost souls in this cage. Even I had to wonder how many of us would walk out on 2 feet. "Listen up," I said, trotting to my left. We soon parted ways with Della, who ran light-footedly for the center of the arena. "We're going to set up an ambush. It's critical that we gain utter surprise. Stand well back and lay low. Half of you hide with veteran Sargon, half with me. We'll watch the rookie group rush in, then hit them in the tail feathers the second they go by us." We rushed through the ferns and vines, leaping over fallen logs and splashing through boggy areas. It only took about a minute to reach the next hatch, the southeast one. Carlos puffed up to me and stood at my side. "Find a hiding spot, specialist," I ordered him.
"I will, but I have a suggestion first."
"Name it, quick-like."
"Someone should play bait, in case they come in cautiously. Someone should stand in the direction of the center and run off when they come in. That way the rest of you can hit them from behind."
"You know," I said, "that's a damn good idea. You're the bunny rabbit. Get out there ahead of them and hide."
"What, me? No way, I'm too slow."
My spear tip wandered close to his face, and he ducked away. "Get out there, bunny," I told him. "Lame bait is the best kind. They'll figure they can catch you easily." Cursing in a steady stream, he headed toward the center. About 100 meters in, he stopped and crouched. The rest of us melted into the landscape. All we had to do was wait until our 5-minute head start ran out. I hoped Della had stolen the flag by now, or this mock battle was going to go down as my first disgrace as a centurion. The other teams only had to walk in and take it. The hatch groaned open on massive hinges. A group of nervous-looking punks walked in holding their spears like they were hunting a saber-tooth.
"This way,"
Harris said, taking the lead. He didn't have much choice with this crew. They had to be led or they'd freeze up. For the next few seconds, everything went pretty well. Harris got about halfway to Carlos's position when the bio-specialist jumped up and bolted. Harris roared and gave chase, as did his crew. All around us in the jungle, my own hidden people tensed, ready to spring up and charge into their rear line. But then, Harris went off script. He threw his spear after Carlos. It was a mighty cast. Even I was impressed. Both accurate and hard-hitting, the spear caught Carlos between the shoulder blades. There was a snapping sound and a bluish flash. Wow, these sticks could give a mean jolt. Carlos spun around and went down. I couldn't see him in the underbrush, but I could see the spear sprouting up out of his back. He'd been gigged like a frog. Already I could see my plans were falling apart. I needed a new plan. Instead of charging off into the jungle after Carlos,
The recruits were cautiously advancing behind their hero Harris, who was bragging about the first kill of the day. It was up to me to make the next move. I decided to take a page from Harris's book. I stood up, trotted a few feet, and chucked my spear at Harris himself. One of the recruits stepped in the way at the last second, and the spear went right through his neck. He fell onto his face, gargling and such like. The stunned recruits were too green to respond properly. They looked at their fallen comrade, not back at me. It was only a split second, but that was enough. A dozen more spears rose and fell. Recruits were taken out with jolts and impalement. Apparently, my troops had decided we were throwing our weapons away today as a group. The tactic seemed insane at first, but it turned out to work pretty well. Any group, especially rookies, can only take so much. With a third of their number knocked down all at once, some broke and fled into the jungle. The rest listened to Harris and circled around him. Sargon and his troops advanced on their flank with confidence, while my well-rested regulars followed, stalking them head-on. We had the eyes of killers, and the greenies in the middle had the eyes of prey.
"McGill!" roared Harris. "You did this just to screw with me, didn't you? Don't you even care about winning? This is a sorry attempt at revenge."
"Not so, adjunct," I shouted back. "I'm in it to win it." We marched forward, half of us with spears leading the way. We outnumbered them by about 3-1 now. They didn't want to toss any more spears. They knew they'd be torn apart if they had nothing left but knives. The lines clashed, flashing shock sticks slapping at one another. But this is where Sargon's superior training really came into play. He was confident and accurate. He'd fought with any number of weapons. Like a wild man, he beat aside the opposing team's spears and jolted their bellies with impunity. Harris was the one and only problem. He grabbed up fallen spears behind his retreating line and threw them with deadly effect. Three of my troops fell, but at last Harris's line crumbled. One poor bastard even tried to surrender.
"You friggin' coward!" Harris screamed at him. "Get up off your knees!"
The man refused, so Harris planted a knife in his skull. The second he did so, Sargon shocked him down, and a brutal butchery began. Harris and his people had been beaten.
"A few of them got away," Sargon told me.
"Yeah, but they'll probably hide in the bushes like rabbits until this is over," I said. "Let's move to the center." I checked on Carlos as we passed him by, and he'd bled out during the battle. That was just as well, I figured. I picked up his kit and tossed it to the nearest troop, who was scratched up. She began smearing medical salves over her bloody legs. We grabbed up spears. Most of us had more than one by now. The throwing tactic, I liked that. Moving forward with caution, I had Sargon do the scouting. We couldn't afford to walk into an ambush like the one I'd just sprung on Harris. At the center of the jungle, we found a ring of some 60 spearmen. They were organized into two ranks, with the back rank standing and the front rank kneeling. They'd gathered around whatever cover they could, but that wasn't much. There were only a few dozen stone blocks and squatty palms here, with knee-high grass all around. In the center of the spearmen was a staff-like stick about 3 meters high. I could still see a scrap of red cloth from the banner that had once flown there. From a range of about 50 meters or so, I stood fast and waved to Leeson. He was standing on the tallest block in the center. Toro was lower down, walking among the recruits and no doubt telling them encouraging things.
"Leeson," I shouted. "What are you doing out there?"
"Winning,"
he boomed back at me.
"I don't think so. That's not the flag. That's a stick."
"The flag is the place, McGill," he said confidently. "A location, not a..."
"Do it, Sargon," I whispered to my side. Trotting forward in a crouch, Sargon advanced in the tall grass. He was like a leopard or something even more impressive. Jumping up on top of a block myself, I stood as high as I could and laughed at Leeson.
"That's a stick, man, not a flag. You're losing. We've got the flag."
"You're so full of shit, McGill," Leeson said hotly. "I don't know who you blew to get Centurion. Wait, no, on second thought..."
He never finished the sentence.
His nervous recruits had been busy looking back and forth between me and Leeson like a crowd at a tennis match. They never saw Sargon until he sprang up about 20 meters out and cast his spear. It was a beautiful thing to watch. Sargon had been a weaponeer before he'd reached veteran, and those boys have to work out every damn day to carry their heavy guns around. You wouldn't think that a man of our day and age would be good with a spear, and most weren't. But some still believed in the old sports, such as the javelin. All of us had trained over the years with various pieces of improvised weaponry anyway, just in case. This was the day it paid off. The spear went a little bit low, catching Leeson in the belly. But that did the trick. He pitched off his perch and went down howling. Shaken, his recruits didn't know what to do. The front ranks stood from their kneeling position, and to me, it looked like they might turn chicken and run. To her credit, Adjunct Toro instantly recognized that she was in charge of 2 terrified platoons now.
"Charge!" she roared. "They cheated! Kill them all!"
Legion recruits, even the fresh ones, aren't generally wimps. They're usually at least jocks, if not true soldiers. A few of them were probably pissed off at seeing their commander taken out by surprise. They came at us then. But it wasn't quite a charge. It was more of an organized trot. No one wanted to be the first man to come up against us. They caught up with Sargon, however. He'd just been a little too close. He took a dozen thrusts in the back, but still managed to hamstring one recruit with his knife before he gave up the ghost. "Single rank," I ordered, and my people formed a sharp line. "Thin them out at 20 paces. Everyone on our side with a second spear threw one at the advancing line. About a dozen of the recruits went down. Sargon wasn't the only one with good aim, if I do say so myself. Taking casualties is never what a line wants to see, but they still outnumbered us badly. They came in, and our 2 lines clashed. It was a mess after that. Screams burned through the air. We stung, stabbed, and slashed at one another. I realized along the way that whole battles in the distant past had been fought just like this. The Roman legions that were our namesakes must have warred this way, so close up and personal. It wasn't like shooting from a crouched position in a foxhole at a target you could barely see. The smell, the noise, it was terrifying and mesmerizing all at once. The battle didn't end the way it would have in ancient times, however. Those brave warriors of the past only had one life to live. They would have broken one side or the other, running away before half of them had fallen. But that wasn't the way with modern legionnaires. We knew that running would mean the enemy would stick us in the back. Bearing the curse and privilege of knowing deep inside that we would be coming back to bear consequences for our actions, we were less willing to take that chance. So we stuck it out. Even the opposing recruits, God bless them, didn't break until there were only about 15 left. Finally, exhausted and bleeding, they turned tail and fled for the forest. My troops made to follow, but I called them back. "Let them go," I said. "They did well." Tiredly, my last handful of survivors returned and laid out flat on the rocks all around the stick that was our prize. It hardly looked like it was worth dying over, to be honest. Della appeared a few minutes later and brought me my flag. She tossed it to me, and I used it to wipe up blood on my ribs.
"I wasn't sure if I should come back or not," she said. "I watched the whole thing from that tree over there."
"You did it right," I told her. Della came close, fussing over my wounds. I let her.
"It felt wrong," she said. "Not fighting with you down here on the ground. Did you send me away to keep me safe?"
"If I did, I'll never tell." She smiled, and she kissed me. Chapter 19. I slept with Della that night. I hadn't planned to do so, but a man like me rarely plans such events. We just take whatever opportunities arise. It felt strange, as I hadn't been with her in a long time. We'd sort of raised a child, and we tried to connect and make a life out of it. But in the end, we were just too different. We had a mutual physical attraction, of course. That had never been the problem. But Della was a true wild woman. She was the kind of person that I figured Etta would grow up to be. My father had always said that some dogs are just too wild, too mean and ornery to keep around. That was how it was with Della. If most women were poodles or beagles, well, she was more like a purebred wolf. After a night in my private officer's quarters, we parted ways with a smile and a kiss. There were no promises to mend our feelings or make a fresh go of it. That part was kind of refreshing. There was a deep honesty underlying our failed relationship that most people could only dream of. Sarah came to me later that morning in my office. That was a surprise.
Centurion?
She asked me timidly. Normally a centurion didn't talk directly to recruits. That was for the veterans. They served as mother, father, nursemaid, and angry primitive god for the recruits. But she was cute and young. I'd seen her lying dead in the grass the day before. Somehow that made me feel soft on her this morning. "What is it, recruit?" I asked. Sarah touched her blonde hair. It was shorter now, but there was still enough to encircle her face nicely. The modern legions weren't as rigid about buzzing off new people's hair as they once were. The creation of discipline through making everyone look alike wasn't as necessary as it used to be. After they died a few times, the recruits tended to listen to you very closely.
"I fought like an animal out there," she said quietly. "I didn't know I could be like that, that other people I knew could kill me, and I could kill them."
"Unfortunately," I told her, "the only way we know how to train troops to fight like experienced soldiers is to give them actual experience in combat."
"I know that, sir," she said. "But something happened to me out there. Something strange. I felt wild. I had a dream when I died, too."
Her eyes came up and met mine, big baby blues looking right at me.
"Is that normal?"
she asked, her voice down to a near whisper. Right about then, I began wishing I had sent her to a veteran. I thought about doing it now, but I didn't. "Sometimes that happens," I admitted.
"How could it?"
she demanded suddenly, loudly, staring at me.
"Was it real?"
"I don't think so," I told her. "It's like deja vu. It's an illusion." Sarah looked down again, but she didn't leave.
"You want to know what I dreamt about?"
she asked, quietly, stepping closer. Suddenly I sensed I was in danger. I was a centurion now, not a regular soldier or even a non-com. To take advantage of this poor girl's obvious distress, which had clearly turned her into a seductress in some kind of cruel psychological twist, well, it would be plain wrong. Still, she was pretty. I knew myself well enough to know I'd succumb to the situation eventually if I didn't unload her sweetness right quick. Maybe not today, as I'd already spent the night with Della, but eventually. Accordingly, I smiled big and stepped past her out of my office. I walked toward the main chamber of our pod. Sarah was surprised, but she trotted after me. Every unit had its own pod for use during transport. They were generally cubical in shape, about 100 meters square, and built to house troops comfortably enough. "You've given me an idea," I told her. "Let's gather up the whole unit." Using my tapper, I alerted my adjuncts and non-coms to gather the unit for an immediate assembly. They hustled troops out of their beds, bathrooms, and hallways in a hurry. When they were all organized, lined up, and looking bewildered, I stood in front of my collective command. "Yesterday was a tough day for many of you," I told them, "especially those who died. That probably wasn't your first death, and it won't be your last." They looked at me. The recruits were bleary-eyed from a bad night's sleep. The regulars ranged from bored to curious. "Normally," I said, "a unit is given a day off to recover after an exercise like the one we just went through. I, however, don't ascribe to that theory. I think unit cohesion needs to be reestablished. Therefore, we'll drill today on the shooting range all afternoon. You have until lunch to get your shit together and turn your new brains back on. Dismissed. Stunned, the unit wandered off. There were some mutters and curses. That was fine with me. I watched them melt away until most were gone. Sarah was one of those who left dejectedly. I felt a little bad for her, but I figured we were done with introspection, sympathy, sex, and navel-gazing for today. Harris was one of the few who stuck around. He walked up to me, narrowing his eyes. "What is it, adjunct?" I asked him. He shook his head as if wondering at something.
"I don't know what to think," he said.
"Yeah, you want to talk about it? Maybe you had a bad dream when you were dead?"
"Say what?" he demanded angrily. "Hell no. My problem is I don't know what to think about you. Yesterday, that was plain dirty. The dirtiest move I've ever seen played out in that scenario."
I shrugged. I wasn't promoted for my personality.
"Damn right you weren't," he said. "You picked me out to ambush, didn't you? Or was it chance?"
"Which way would make you feel better, adjunct? I'm all about feelings." He squinted at me again and shook his head.
"Graves himself couldn't have been more heartless, and I doubt he could have been more cunning. Why didn't you just sit in the middle of that damn jungle like any normal centurion would have done? Why'd you have to screw with the flag, knock out an enemy group, all that shit?"
I shrugged. "To win." Harris nodded.
"All right," he said. "I could accept that. A new centurion needs to demonstrate he's an ass-kicker."
As Harris continued talking, my mind began to wander. It seemed that he was trying to figure out my angle in the training. The God's honest truth was I hadn't been thinking about any higher level of learning from my command. The contest was a game of sorts, and I'd wanted to win. I always wanted to win. It was that simple. Leeson or some other similar officer might have stood his troops around the flag, fought hard, and possibly won anyway against a pack of green recruits. But that wasn't my way. Listening to Harris, vaguely, it occurred to me that telling him the truth about my motives wouldn't expand my mystique in his mind, so I let him carry on trying to fathom my alleged genius without help.
"One last thing," he said finally, forcing me to pay attention again. "What about today's drill? Why hit them hard right off? Is there something I need to know? Are we going into action earlier than planned?"
"Nope," I said. "I just got tired of seeing my people mope around. It's best to keep them busy. Forget your troubles. Don't dwell on them. That's my motto."
He nodded seriously. "A good motto. That's all, sir."
After lunch, my unit hit the shooting range. There was an inspection going on when we got there. Leading my unit to the lines, we took up our assigned weapons and began practicing. The recruits were given snap rifles, standard issue for our greenest troops. The regulars were given plasma weapons. We formed two groups and began firing. There were two other units using the chamber. A group of higher-level officers walked along, reviewing their performance. Graves and Winslade were among the officers performing the inspection. They seemed surprised to see my group when they approached.
"I believe these men are part of your cohort, Graves," Winslade said. "I'm surprised they aren't shooting my men in the next field by accident."
"McGill," Graves asked, "why are you drilling your troops today?"
"To clear their minds, sir," I said crisply. I worked a plasma rifle charging pod out of the stock and replaced it with another. I rammed the spent pod into a slot in the rail that ran between me and the firing range to recharge. Flipping the rifle back on, I heard the weapon hum. It was a sound that rose in pitch until it became an inaudibly high singing sound. That meant it was good to go. Graves didn't say anything for a second, but soon he nodded in approval.
"Carry on."
I turned and fired at the target. A robotic monster flailed as it was taken down. After about 5 seconds, it got up again and began moving in random circles. I shot it again. Sensing a presence at my side, I glanced to my left. It was Winslade.
"Can I help you, Primus?" I asked him.
Winslade peered up at me.
"You're bucking for more rank, aren't you?"
he asked.
"Excuse me?"
"Who ignores a day off to go shooting after an ordeal in the arena? Only a man with unbridled ambition would even think of it."
Think what you like, Primus, but my men do best when they keep busy.
Yes, I can see that. I'll keep an eye on you, McGill. You're a dangerous man.
Thank you, sir. He left me then, and the inspection ended. I went back to shooting, and I actually found it cathartic. There was something about firing a powerful weapon and knocking down an alien over and over again, even an artificial alien, which I found very enjoyable. Chapter 20. After Drusus had been promoted up to Imperator and then Equestrian, he became too high and mighty to run a legion like Varus. Accordingly, a new tribune was appointed. However, that honor didn't fall to Winslade, who'd disgraced himself early on in the battle for Earth. Friends from high places on the ruling council had kept people like Winslade and Turov from being run out of town on a rail, but they hadn't managed to get them any new rank. Instead, people of worth were advanced. In my opinion, Tribune Helena Deitch was one of them. On the one hand, she was a real piece of work. She wasn't pretty and she wasn't nice, but she was effective. Looking to be around 35, she had tight, curly hair and lots of freckles. Most people had edited that kind of thing out by the time they had reached a high rank, but not old Deitch.
"You know what they say about our new tribune?" Carlos asked me during our general assembly.
"What, that she's Deitch the Peach?" He made a face of disgust.
"Nah, that's lame. They say she's a ball buster, that she hates men and attractive women. She only likes ugly old battle axes like herself."
"Huh," I said, gazing across the open expanse of the transport's upper deck. "I don't think she looks all that bad." Under my unit's feet was our home pod. The whole legion was in the hold, standing on top of a stack of identical pods. The hull of the big transport arced overhead and the ribs of the ship loomed near. Each one was 10 meters thick and forged with pure crystalline steel. Deitch didn't bother to walk in front of the whole legion and inspect us. She floated on a flitter above the cohorts, staring down from her whirring platform at us.
"Officers, veterans, and recruits," she said. "This is my first action as the overall commander of Legion Varus. I'm proud to serve with you."
"This is bullshit," Carlos muttered. "Varus should be led by someone from Varus. She's from Iron Eagles. They don't know shit about us, about our culture."
"Culture?" I asked. "We kill stuff for a living. What's there to know?" Carlos looked sullen. I wondered why people always disliked outsiders from the first minute they ran into them. For my part, I was more than willing to give this old battle axe a fair shake.
"This operation should be a simple one," Deitch went on. "In fact, we shouldn't even be deploying an entire legion for such a small matter. A group of renegade lab workers have refused to abandon their facilities. They've been warned and warned again. Earth can only tolerate so much defiance."
We stared up at her, listening, frowning. So far, she did sound like a hard ass. I wasn't disappointed.
"Legion Varus has always served in special duty cases like this one. It might get messy if they try to actively resist. It's even possible they'll use specialized experimental weapons against you."
"Are they going to throw beakers and microscopes at us?" Carlos demanded aloud.
"Shut up, and maybe she'll tell us," I told him. I'd let him get away with talking to me because we were friends, but I knew that couldn't continue in front of the troops. I was a centurion now, not a recruit in the back row. To Carlos's credit, he did shut up.
"Now that we're underway," Deitch continued, "I can reveal some details about our mission. First of all, it is important. The Galactics have outlawed weapons research of the kind that's been taking place at this facility. When Earth took over the cephalopod worlds, it took us some time to figure out what we'd gained and what we'd taken responsibility for."
She swept the crowd with a stern gaze. Nobody was laughing now. We knew trouble when we heard it. Galactic legal violations topped the charts in that department.
"Our government let the work continue in secret for a time. But when the Galactics were detected returning with their battle fleet, it was decided such efforts must be shut down and expunged. That's our true mission, to not only remove the scientists, but also to delete all evidence that might be incriminating."
Deitch began praising us as a legion after that. She listed our accomplishments and talked about how respected we were. She then applied the old saw about doing the dirty work that needed doing. That's when I knew she was wrapping it up. Your individual officers will brief you on operational objectives. Train hard. Don't assume the mission will be easy, even though it probably will be. Dismissed. The Legion melted back into their pods over the next several minutes. I didn't go below decks, however. I watched a knot of officers approach Deitch. Most of them were centurions, and there was a primus or two. Taking my new rank seriously, I walked toward them and joined the circle.
That's right, Deitch was saying. There is no comprehensive list of their security systems or their experimental weaponry.
But, sir, Winslade whined, how are we supposed to fight effectively against unknown weaponry? Surely someone took notes during their initial surveys of the cephalopod worlds, if only—
No, Deitch said firmly. The answer is no, and it will continue to be no until you stop asking.
I almost said something rude, but I contained myself. Winslade was getting beat up by the Tribune enough on his own without me chiming in.
We see security installation references on these maps, Graves said. We've never gotten any details concerning them. Are they classified as well?
They're all classified. The very existence of the target planet is classified. However, I can tell you the pillboxes are automated and of cephalopod manufacture. They aren't particularly innovative, but they're doubtlessly effective.
That caused a bit of a stir. I'd sort of been envisioning a guard post manned by security men in space suits. It would be a lot harder to take out hardened bunkers with some kind of squid AI shooting at you.
Can we turn those defensive mechanisms off? Graves asked.
They wouldn't be terribly effective if that was easy to do, Deitch pointed out. Their power lines are buried in solid rock underneath the pillboxes. They're fed from generators inside the central dome itself.
Couldn't we just bomb the dome from space and have done with it? I called out from the back row. A dozen pair of eyes swung to look at me.
I mean, I continued, if we're going to blow the whole place up anyway, why not do it right off?
Deitch stared at me.
I'm not sure I've met you, Centurion McGill?
That's me, sir.
Well, McGill, there are some things we wish to retrieve from the dome intact before we destroy it.
Like what kinds of things? Her demeanor shifted from open but measured to downright annoyed. I'd seen that happen before on any number of times in different folks.
Last time, Centurion. Your team may not be targeting one of them, and thus you haven't been briefed on that part of the operation, which is classified.
There was some freckle-faced daggers with that last part. Still, I almost asked another question until I caught a simultaneous glare from Winslade and Graves. They couldn't both be wrong, so I paused. It occurred to me that up until my question, only the Primus-ranked individuals had asked anything. Accordingly, I shut up. The informal meeting wrapped up after a few more minutes, and I was left wandering back toward my unit's pod.
Why do I always get the urge to cringe when you open your mouth, McGill?
Winslade asked from behind me.
Well, sir, I said, looking back at him and giving him a grin.
Sometimes a big man's voice will make a small man jump. It's nothing to be ashamed of. It's purely natural. He huffed and walked away. Primus Graves caught up with me next.
You shouldn't talk to a superior officer like that, McGill, he told me.
Didn't you execute him once a few years back? I asked him. He shrugged.
I've executed you as well, several times. The problem is I can't seem to get it to stick.
He gave me a tight smile, and I realized he'd made a joke. I laughed politely. That was hard because Graves had killed me lots of times. It could be hard to forgive a man for that.
Have you got any more info? I asked him. Anything on the mission, I mean? Who was going after the classified stuff?
Graves jerked a thumb over his shoulder.
Winslade, for one. Go ask him about it.
I stopped walking and let Graves continue on. Frowning, I looked around but couldn't see where the weasel had gone. He'd vanished into one of the hatches on top of the pods. Like a rat down a hole, he'd disappeared. I didn't like the idea of Winslade being in charge of collecting secret weapons and the like. I couldn't even comprehend why, with his record, a man like him would be trusted on a mission like this at all. That was the problem with Earth, in my opinion. The government was blind to so many injustices and absurdities. One man might go to jail for espionage, while his office mate might get a promotion. The government types had a way of making things even more unfair in nature than they already were. By trying to keep an open mind, they often let the wolves in with the sheep. Chapter 21. 2 days later, we arrived in the vicinity of Arcturus, coming out of warp a long way from the central star. This came as a surprise to me, as Arcturus was pretty near, in astronomical terms, to Old Sol herself. I would have thought it would be safe to warp in closer to the target. Wanting to know what we might be dealing with, I sought out the smartest person I knew. Calling upon my own best tech, Natasha, I didn't get a helpful reply at first.
"Arcturus is a K-class star," she said. "Not all that much different from our own sun."
I made a great effort and did not roll my eyes. "I know that. I'm wondering why we're here. Because we're supposed to be checking up on a cephalopod world. This planet is too close. We're well inside the borders of Province 921. This is a long way from squid space. It can't be a star system we conquered during the war." She shrugged her shoulders and went back to studying something with a virtual nanoscope.
"That's politics, not science. You'll have to ask someone else more qualified."
She didn't seem to care about what I considered to be a technical mystery, which was odd in itself. There she sat, ignoring me, peering at her work. I decided to get a good look at what was so doggone curious.
"What's visible in that scope that's so damned interesting?" I asked her. "Nothing. Just manufacturing marks."
That raised my interest level right off. I knew that any manufacturing marks which took specialized equipment to identify must be imperial in nature.
"You're looking for an imperial stamp?" I asked her.
Her head came back up from her scope, suddenly alert.
"What do you know about that?"
"I know the galactic stamp, the things they make themselves with tiny identifying collections of molecules. It's common knowledge."
"No, it isn't,"
she said, staring at me suspiciously. Immediately, I knew I'd blown it. I'd learned about imperial stamps because they identified the most valuable kind of equipment I'd come into contact with. The teleport suits, for example, were very advanced and originally of galactic manufacture. The reason such items were a big deal was because lowlifes, like humans, out on the fringe of the known galaxy, weren't supposed to have access to that kind of goods, ever. What's more, I'd once had a galactic key among my personal possessions, an extinction-level offense if it was discovered. "Why are you looking for stamps anyway?" I asked, seeking a fresh dodge. "Does it have something to do with the coming audit?" Her mouth opened, then closed again. She turned back to her nanoscope.
"I know I'm in your unit, James," she said. "Technically, I'm under your command. But I've been asked to examine various items to see if they had certain markers, and I can't talk about it."
Curious now, I sidled close to her and stared at the item she was examining. It didn't look all that special. "Is that some kind of actuator?" I asked. "Looks like it connects to something big." Natasha quickly moved the flat of her hand between the object and my prying eyes.
"I thought I was questioning you,"
she said, looking over her shoulder at me. "Apparently you thought wrong." She looked around the lab. It was pretty empty except for a few bored-looking techs who were working on unimportant stuff. Mostly they were equipment checking for tomorrow's planned deployment.
"All right," she said. "You tell me why you know about imperial stamps. I'll tell you what I'm examining."
I thought about that and I nodded. "Okay."
"You first," she said.
"Wait.
This was my idea," she insisted.
Heaving a sigh, I gave in and lied. It was only a partial lie, which meant it was one of the best kind. "The teleport suits are galactic made," I said. At least the original ones were.
My God, she said, staring into space. That makes sense. No one told me. But how did you find out about that?
Well, I squirmed a little. I was in the early teleport attack program.
Yes, so? How did that get you into the loop on manufacturing marks?
I paused to gather my thoughts for a moment. The truth was I'd possessed a galactic key, a powerful hacking tool that was strictly forbidden for humans to possess. It could bypass alien security, even if that security was built by the galactics themselves. That's when I learned about the stamps. I couldn't tell Natasha about that, though. Only a few people knew the keys existed at all, and I thought it should stay that way. Well, I finally said, during the teleport trials I met a tech. Lisa was her name. She knew about the Imperial stamp on the suits and told me about it.
Why would she...
Natasha began, then she stopped and made a wry face.
Oh, let me guess. Lisa is attractive?
She's a fine-looking woman, I admitted, but she doesn't hold a candle to your aristocratic cheekbones. She heaved a sigh and shook her head, going back to her work.
I should have known. Pillow talk is dangerous.
Your turn, I said.
All right, but you can't tell anyone I told you. This is part of our warp bubble generation system. It's a specialized part that maintains a perfect balance between numerous high-energy emissions.
Huh?
It's a critical component of warp engines. We only have so many of these, and the Skrull aren't sending us any new ones. We might have to build our own someday.
Ah, I said, catching on. So you're trying to copy the design. That's a serious violation of galactic law, you know.
We perform more and more such violations all the time.
She was more right than she knew, but I couldn't tell her about it. Hell, she wouldn't be able to concentrate on her work at all if I did. But what about Arcturus IV? I asked. Where are we?
I seriously don't know. But there are planets here. None of them are inhabitable, but they were first cataloged long ago.
I squinted at her. So, is it likely one or more of these worlds would be rocky with a toxic atmosphere?
I would assume so, she said. The New Tribune stated in her briefing that we were heading to such a planet. That would make sense given this star's high metallicity.
Pretend I skipped that day in astronomy class, I said. What the hell is metallicity?
A measurement of how much a given star's mass is anything other than hydrogen or helium, she said. Stars with high metallicity levels produce rocky planets. Life itself would be impossible without them.
Yeah, I said thoughtfully. I think I'm going to go talk to some other people now. Her hand shot out and caught mine. I stopped and looked at her in surprise. It had been a long time since she'd touched me at all. We'd had a serious relationship once, and we still did, but it was all in the old friend category now.
Don't get any ideas, she said, retrieving her hand. Remember, you can't tell anyone what I've told you.
They'll never know where I got it, I assured her. Her eyes searched mine. She heaved a fresh sigh.
What's wrong now? I asked. I realize that you're promising to lie. That means what you've been telling me about Imperial markers was a lie, too.
Oh, come on, I said. What I said wasn't a total lie. It was an adjustment. I was only trying to protect you.
Whatever. You haven't changed a bit.
Troubled, I frowned at her. I did it for your own good, Natasha. Believe me. She looked troubled right back at me, and then she stopped asking questions. Natasha was right about one thing. We'd come to Arcturus for political reasons, not technical ones. That realization gave me the impetus to head upstairs to Gold Deck. That's where the real answers to my questions were. Chapter 22. In the old days, I would have stormed into Turov's office. After a little bargaining, I'd have learned whatever I needed to know. Unfortunately, Turov was back on Earth, and Tribune Deitch was nowhere near as inviting. In fact, I couldn't even get in the door.
"Sorry, Centurion," said a veteran guard, shaking his head. "The Tribune isn't taking walk-ins today. Her schedule is full."
"Not a problem," I said. "If I could just talk to her aide..."
"I'm afraid she's left specific instructions on that score, sir."
I blinked.
"He... what? You mean he told you not to allow me into this door? Me, by name?"
"I'm afraid so," he said, consulting his tapper.
"Yes, Centurion... McGill, that's you, right?"
This unexpected resistance flummoxed me. For years, I'd been told by countless adjuncts and veterans I didn't rate a direct audience with superior officers. Now, however, I'd attained the rank of centurion myself. Hell, Deitch was only 2 steps above me in the command chain.
"Who is this new aide working for Tribune Deitch?" I demanded. "Unless asking for that much is against the rules."
"Not at all, sir. Primus Winslade has been newly appointed to the post."
Winslade? That worm.
He'd already managed to wangle a key staff role working for Deitch. My mind raced. Winslade was like me in a way, but much more slippery. While I'd been drilling my troops and prepping for battle, he'd been thrown sniffing his way to the top of the lapdog list. The moment he'd achieved his goal of avoiding hard combat, he'd set himself up as a gatekeeper to kick away rivals like myself. Compared to Winslade, I was a political dunce. But I wouldn't have had it any other way.
"All right," I told the veteran. "I'm leaving, but I'll be back."
When I returned to my unit, my adjuncts were arguing. That's the trouble with having 3 of them. They all wanted to run the show when I wasn't around.
"Leeson," I called out.
"Yes, sir, Centurion,"
he said, wheeling around. I liked that. No matter what kind of an unimaginative ass Leeson had been in the past, he'd never seemed to resent my promotions like the others did. Toro was clearly irritated about my rise through the ranks. Even though Leeson had been around longer than both of us, she took it personally that she was senior and should have gotten the promotion long before yours truly. And Harris? Well, Harris and I had been at each other's throats for years. Only in combat did we gel and cooperate. Whenever we were at peace and the revival machines were idling, he complained about every friggin' thing I did.
"Leeson," I said, "as my senior adjunct in this unit, you're officially in charge when I'm not on deck. Is that clear?"
"Very clear,"
Leeson said proudly.
"I am senior."
Due to our long lifespans and terms of service, which could go on damn near forever, seniority was less important than it had been in traditional military structures. People didn't get drafted, or get old, or retire out at a certain age. In fact, a chronologically older person might even be physically younger than their juniors because they'd been recently revived. The end result was a command ladder that was less rigid when it came to years served. The other 2 adjuncts looked glum, but they quieted down. It looked like order had been restored, but that was just an illusion.
"In your absence this morning, sir," Harris said, "we've been discussing what we should do training-wise. This is, after all, our last opportunity to get these recruits ready for action."
"Harris wants to kill them," Leeson said flatly. "But I'm against any extreme action for our final day. The men won't be any good if they're traumatized when we face a real enemy."
"With all due respect," Harris said angrily, "that's the whole point. Recruits are going to die in the field anyway. They need to get their fears hammered out of them right now."
Harris was one of those guys who liked to say, "with all due respect," when he actually meant you could go screw yourself. Thoughtful, I turned to Adjunct Toro.
"What do you think we should do for our last day?" I asked her.
The left side of her mouth twitched.
"I'm surprised you're asking me," she said in a snotty tone. "You're the Centurion. Don't you know what the right play is?"
I was finally getting pissed off at all of them. They were bickering still. It was less open, but it was still there. To my mind, the whole thing was an insult. None of them figured I was a legit commander, so they were trying to take over by putting out their own ideas or downright foot-dragging. Well, there were ways to get the attention of underlings. I'd seen Graves handle similar situations on many occasions. Thanks for the thoughtful input, adjunct, I told Toro. She frowned in confusion, but I pressed on. We're going to have ourselves another contest. This one should be less deadly, but still a teachable moment for the whole unit. They looked at me with vague curiosity. First off, I said, we'll break out shock batons for everyone. Not those spear things, they're too deadly. To make it interesting, we'll have three troops in each heat. One man from each of your three platoons. We'll start with the lower ranks and work our way up with winners going to a second round. Let's get started.
Just one thing, Centurion, Leeson said. How far are the troops supposed to go? To the death?
Nah, death might happen, but the point here is to beat the hell out of each other and get to the top of the pyramid.
He nodded thoughtfully.
You mentioned shock batons, Toro said. What about armor? Will our heavies be allowed to wear it?
She was asking because her platoon was made up of heavy troopers. In our previous exercise, they'd all led greenies from around the cohort. This action would be only for people in our own unit, who were mostly regulars.
No, I said firmly. In fact, we'll strip everyone down to their skivvies from the start. No equipment advantages for anybody.
Finally, Harris began to smile.
This does sound like fun, he said. My lights are trained to fight with nothing. They might do better than people expect with a level playing field.
Leeson looked glum. He was in charge of the bio people, techs, and a few weaponeers. Sure, his weaponeers were tough, and the others were experienced, but most of them weren't front-line troops. To his credit, he didn't complain about it. In past operations, we'd often deployed and fought with full cohorts of light troops or heavy troops. This time, our units were all mixed. We had so many specialized tactical objectives and so little understanding of what we were going to face, the higher-ups had decided to organize us that way. We decided to hold the contest in the main exercise room when it was unoccupied. We could only reserve it for a few hours, so we had to get moving right away. Each platoon chose an individual combatant, and I let my adjuncts make the choices themselves. The atmosphere was like that of a sporting match. The adjuncts marched among their people, evaluating, giving advice and encouragement.
All right, send in your first man, I ordered.
The ring was about 30 feet in diameter. Stepping out or getting pushed out meant you were disqualified. Otherwise, the last trooper on their feet was the winner. Harris picked a capable-looking man with long arms and shifty eyes. Toro sent in a girl in response, and to my surprise, I recognized her. It was none other than Sarah, that young girl I'd shared a moment with back at Central. Leeson chose last. Despite his mediocre leadership skills, he was a cagey devil when it came to strategy. He ordered Sargon into the field. I thought about that, and I nodded in approval. He clearly saw Sarah as weak and the rangy-looking guy as beatable. If he played Sargon now, he was almost sure to win and send him on to the second round. The first fight began when I whistled. The three stepped into the ring, looking wary. Sarah looked downright scared, and there was a certain look of desperation in her eyes. Sargon roared and charged at her right off. She skidded backward and almost walked out of the ring. Seeing his opportunity, the shifty-eyed light trooper rushed in toward Sargon's flank. He was fast. Unfortunately for him, Sargon was vastly more experienced. Sargon seemed to know where the man was and exactly how he would attack. He whirled around, ducked, and thrust his baton into the man's belly. There was a crack of electricity and a flash of blue-white light. The recruit ate dirt, puked, and passed out in convulsions. Sarah, to my surprise, darted in and actually landed one on Sargon's shoulder. His left arm went limp, and he spun back to her, howling in pain. I winced, knowing what was likely to happen next. But Sargon didn't destroy her, not utterly. Instead, he kicked out at gut level, and she was tossed ass over tea kettle right out of the ring. It was over, and the crowd cheered. They'd been making quite a bit of noise during the contest, and they went wild when Sarah landed her baton. Even after she was kicked out, her team gathered around her and congratulated her on a good battle. Of the three adjuncts, only Leeson looked worried. He'd won, but his man was hurt. The numbness of a shock baton would fade, but it might take as long as an hour to do so.